Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 21st of July.
And welcome to you all. Thanks welcome. For tuning in.
Thank you so much again, as ever. We're very grateful for your listens.
Certainly are.
Yeah. Well, and this week's a bit different, really, isn't it?
Yeah, we've gone on the road a bit.
Yeah, all the way to Westminster.
It's a long way.
It was. And we met with the wonderful... Is that too strong?
No, I think it's absolutely spot on.
Wonderful Caroline Lucas,
who
MP.
Who is very sadly... Yeah. Departing Parliament. Yeah. And we talked to her about that and why she's leaving.
Yeah.
And we talked to her about her views on public standards in public life and also about her quite crisp views on Keir Starmer's failures on the Green agenda.
Yeah, she was very strong on Keir Starmer.
She was. And I have a feeling that, to quote the old Tony Benn line about giving up Parliament so he can pursue a career in politics. I think she's only getting started, which is good news.
Oh, listen, mate, I found it. I've always admired her because it must be a hard gig being the only member of your party in all that seat, but also being a woman as well in a place that can be condescending and misogynistic, you know, and hopefully that's changing for the better. But she is so kind of measured and smart and intelligent. Yeah. I think she's going to be a big loss on those benches.
She'll be a big loss to Parliament and perhaps a big gain to the broader public sphere.
I hope so.
I think she's got a lot left to say.
I hope so. I also found it interesting, and towards the end, so you'll have to listen, about what she's doing currently as a thing on the side.
Absolutely. And talks about her new book, which is very interesting.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. No, she's a real, really fascinating character. And I was really thrilled that she said yes to be our first interviewee. She was our first target, and she said yes, and she really delivered.
She did not disappoint.
She didn't. So what should we call this episode?
In Praise of Caroline.
In Praise of Caroline?
Or Farewell Caroline.
Farewell, see you soon. we need something better than that.
How about Caroline Lucas Interview?
The Caroline Lucas Interview.
That's what it says on the tin.
So this is The Two Matts, episode 5, The Caroline Lucas Interview.
Enjoy.
Enjoy.
I've just come from Deputy Prime Minister's Questions. So Oliver Dowden was standing in again for Rishi Sunak. And I just think the way that they can stand there and make light of just the hideousness of what this government is doing on everything from the small boats. And one of the questions that made me most angry was the reply about why it was perfectly legitimate and indeed desirable to paint over a mural in a reception centre for children because that's going to deter the boats. I mean, what planet are these people on? So we went from that to the fact that there are 4.3 million children living in poverty, but according to the government, they're doing loads to sort that out. And in fact, the numbers have gone down, they say, which we know isn't true. And then we started off with North Sea oil and gas and being told that new licences in the North Sea are going to be essential in order to get our fuel bills down and guarantee energy security, which is just an outright lie. Parking climate change just for a second. Any oil and gas that is extracted from the North Sea, as you know, will simply get sold on global markets at international prices. So it does nothing for Britain's energy security per se and does a hell of a lot for wrecking the climate. Yeah. So, yeah, I am... I am angry.
I'm definitely going to come back to Rosebank and the oil field Brilliant. Issues about that at some length, please. But, you know, there must have been a dozen or more times just this year that you've come back into your office feeling enraged and frustrated Very and true. Angry. And I went back and I read your maiden speech, and this is in 2010, right? And you said that, you know, what a single MP could do, because you were in this unique position. You know, you were the first new member of a new national party for a long, long time to, yep. to make a maiden speech as a serving MP. And one of the things that struck me is when you said a single MP can challenge the executive. And I wonder now, when you're coming to the end of your time as an MP, whether you felt that's actually true, whether you can challenge them verbally, but can you materially challenge the executive as a single MP?
I think you can change the debate. I think you can put questions on the agenda that weren't there before. I think you can help to mobilise people outside of Parliament as well as inside. I mean, I don't think I meant, even in my maiden speech, that one MP on their own could materially on their own change government policy, clearly. As an opposition MP, no MP can sadly do that on their own, or even with the rest of their party if they are not the government. But I do think, just going back to that moment, and I was looking back at my maiden speech just recently too, in the context of making the decision not to stand again. And sort of two things struck me. One was that it really is quite extraordinary that the people of Brighton did take that leap of faith and did vote for a completely new party, you know, and that we were going to them at a time of huge anger with the political system. It was after the MPs' election expenses and at a time when, you know, there were all kinds of difficulties. And I do still think it was remarkable that they did do that, that they did put their faith in a new party. And I am really proud that I've been re-elected at every election since with an increased majority. One battle that has been won just recently is around a new GCSE in natural history, which might sound a very small thing, but I think does have the potential to be transformative in the sense that it does mean that young people will have a very different experience of learning about nature and actually getting out into nature. But on the big issues, what I can say is that by having a Green in the room, things get onto the agenda that weren't already there. So, for example, I think I was the first MP in a generation to have a big debate in Parliament about drugs law, because at the time I was elected, Brighton was the drugs death capital of Britain. So having a debate about reviewing the Misuse of Drugs Act and seeing what we could do about drugs policy was important. It hasn't led to the change I want to see. So on that level, you could say it wasn't successful. But nonetheless, it's on the agenda now in a way that it wasn't. Parliament has voted for saying that there is a climate emergency. I mean, you know, again, compared to where we need to be, words are cheap. Yes. But 13 years ago, I'm not sure that I would have necessarily thought Parliament would have said, yes, there's a climate emergency.
Would you have been surprised? I suspect you would have been. When you came in as an MP, the beginning of this long Conservative era, the incoming coalition government was at least performatively, at least in theory, sympathetic to green issues.
They were hugging huskies
and recycled trainers and so forth. And here we are in the summer of 2023, and we have a Minister of State saying, you know, this mural for children who have come into this country from horrific circumstances, and it cannot be there because it will encourage and therefore its absence will deter refugees. And we could go on about all the other ways in which the social ethos of this government has changed. Would you have thought that possible?
I don't think I would, actually, which perhaps was complacent or naive, I don't know. But it feels that we're in such a dark place now. And it's so interesting who your heroes become. You know, suddenly Theresa May now is a hero in a way that she certainly never was when she was Prime Minister. But she is standing up for people who are victims of modern slavery, and she is fighting back against her government that is trying to mean that those people won't get any kind of support under this new so-called illegal migration bill. So
is that repentance, do you think, rather than conviction? Because, I mean, she was famously a big proponent of the hostile environment.
She was. I mean, she was the one who sent the vans
exactly,
around, wasn't she, saying...
Yeah.
But I don't know, she has... it would be quite interesting to sort of... really get inside her head and work out the psychology of it, because I do believe she does care about modern slavery. It's kind of weird she doesn't care about all the things that you would imagine would go alongside that for the same reason. In other words, you know, people that are being exploited, not getting kicked further in the stomach. So I agree that it's a bit of an anomaly in one sense, but I do think she actually believes the stuff on modern slavery.
Yeah.
Hearing people like John Major, you know, yeah, speaking out about the total Brexit, drama and horror, or talking about, you know, just the disrepute, which isn't a strong enough word, but I can't think of a stronger one, contempt that Boris Johnson has led the political system into. Mm-hmm. And it really, really matters. That's what I think is so important. You know, it's very easy just to knock all politicians and say we're all the same and they're all crap and they're all on the make. And undoubtedly some are. But I think if you really end up believing that your whole political class is worthy of contempt, then I don't know where you go after that. Yeah. I think you go to very, very scary places. And from my perspective about being, you know, so driven by needing action on climate and nature, you need a government that's got the trust of the people to make the big changes that we urgently need. And when you've got a government that is not just a government, but more than that, you know, just essentially a parliament that is treated and viewed with such contempt, to some extent, understandably so, then I think it's dangerous in so many ways.
Is it harder to be a Green in a populist era? Because necessarily being a Green involves responsibility, a strategic vision, moral principles, rather than just worrying about the next Twitter cycle and emotionalism. Although, of course, emotion can form a big part of environmental belief. Has that made things harder?
I think it has made things harder because it means that green policies are just seen as fair game to be treated as political footballs, as wedge issues, as part of the culture war. And you can see it sort of playing out again just in the chamber just over the last few days, you know, where it's now Rishi Sunak's favourite thing to pretend that Keir Starmer is somehow the political wing of Just Stop Oil. I mean, it's just so stupid and cheap and
if only.
Dangerous. Well, quite. In one sense, if only. Uh-huh. And in another sense, you know, don't make it sound as if anybody who cares about the environment is somehow a fringe group, you know? In so many other countries now, it's just economic logic that, of course, you would factor in environmental concerns as you design policies right across the board. Whereas here it's kind of seen as this sort of fringe weirdness that is just used as a
just
political
another cult.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of maybe really naively assume that even the worst of them believe that there is a climate emergency and that something drastic needs to happen, but they kind of mitigate that knowledge by current day pragmatism, you know, and they justify it to themselves that we've just got to get to the next step. So when you hear Sunak talking about Rosebank oil field and saying, yeah, but you know, we're still net importers of oil, and if we had more of it ourselves, that would help us make the transition. You know, I kind of want to believe that he at least is sincere about that pragmatism. But do you think that there are characters out there who are, you know, in power and just desperately insincere about the state of domestic politics, the state of international politics and crises, and the state of the climate as well, that they're just chancing it?
I think there are a small number who fall into that category, you know, the ones who are linked to Tufton Street, and The Guardian's just done some interesting work looking at the shares that some of them hold in all kinds of oil companies and everything else. So undoubtedly there are some who are just not going to be persuadable and aren't going to come with us. In terms of the government as a whole, do they believe in the climate emergency? I don't think they believe in the word emergency.
Right.
The word emergency suggests that when you dial 999, you want the fire engines to come now, not in 30 years' time. Yeah. And what worries me is that there is no sense of urgency from this government, as well as all of the lies around Rosebank. And I don't know if we can just briefly focus on that for a second, because
absolutely,
it just feels to me the strongest symbol of stupidity, really.
So let me just pause you a second, because we should give
a bit
of context
that is
for the listeners, please.
Yeah. So Rosebank is the biggest undeveloped oil field in the North Sea. The Norwegian company Equinor want to develop it, and right now we're waiting for the government to say whether or not they're going to give the green light to that. And the concern is that they will give the green light. And the point is that they try to defend the decision in terms of energy security or in terms of our energy prices and so forth. And yet with Rosebank, that argument is even more weak and egregious than it is with any other oil field, in the sense that 90% of the oil from Rosebank, and it is mostly oil, will be exported because it's not the kind that we use in UK refineries.
Right.
So this is going to do absolutely bugger all, if I can say that on your lovely podcast, for energy security.
By the way, you can say that and much worse.
Oh,
much
good. Worse. Right. Yeah. Warm up to it.
Wish to, yeah.
It's not in full speech, but we're very open-minded.
Yeah. So it will do nothing for energy security or our prices. But what it will do is, A, drive the climate crisis, and B, you know, we are actually going to hand over to this Norwegian oil company £3.4 billion of taxpayers' money, because there are so many, you know, loopholes, to call it politely, in the windfall tax, and so many ways in which money still goes to the oil companies. If the public understood this, you know, when we're being told that we can't afford to pay nurses or teachers or doctors, and yet we can afford to give it to an oil company from another country to exacerbate the climate crisis. I mean, what planet, frankly, are we all on?
And I kind of know the answer to this question, but what is stopping the public from understanding this, do you think?
It's a really interesting question, because you'd have thought it ought to be fairly clear to be able to understand it. But there is just such a spinning machine coming out of government, you know, all the time. When you ask them about Rosebank, as I have done constantly, they will reply in terms of energy security and cost and so forth. And so you never get the chance to have the second bite at the question. You know what I mean? You ask the question, they reply, and then you move on to the next questioner.
Yeah.
So we've not been able to get it out that way. And I have to say at this point that I am deeply depressed about the Labour Party as well, because if Keir Starmer said right now, if there is a Labour government, we would reverse the decision on Rosebank, that would be enough to give the chilling effect to Equinor, who would think, well, why would we be investing all this money if it's going to get...
That would kill the deal.
It would kill the deal. Yeah. So why would they not do it? Instead of that, you've got Keir Starmer dancing on the head of a pin, saying we won't have any new oil and gas except for the oil and gas that has just been given the green light by the government.
Right.
And when it comes to Rosebank, as I say, it is huge. It's three times bigger than the Cambo oil field that some people may have heard of, which was big enough. So it just doesn't add up.
Yeah, and we've also just last week had the Climate Change Committee's report, where it said, you know, this idea that we're going to be a net zero country by 2050, you know, that 20% of the government's plans are fit for purpose. So 80% of them are not fit for purpose. They're duplicitous. It's a lie. And that's down from 39% whenever it was last year. You know, so the plans are on sand, you know, absolute baloney.
Yeah.
Why is this not screaming from every front page? Why is Keir Starmer not using this as the lead attack on this government, who are blind or worse to the, you know, this existential threat?
I think there are lots of different strands in that question, because I think the public, generally speaking, is really worried about it, and lots of the polls will tell us that. And they're worried about it in spite of having, you know, a drip feed from the right-wing press and from the government that either it's stupid or it's too expensive or whatever else. So I think public concern is real. And certainly when you have those so-called citizens' assemblies, you know, when you get a representative group of people to hear the evidence about climate and say what they think should happen, their proposals are 10 times bolder than anything that we ever hear from any government.
Right.
So I think the public's in one place. I think on so many issues, Labour is just trying to look serious and grown up. And it's very depressing that to look serious and grown up in Labour's eyes, you have to be, you know, for a bit of oil and gas, and you have to be for, you know, massive pay restraint, even though it's not going to fuel inflation because it's the people at the top end of the scale that are fueling inflation. Yeah. So you've got that happening. You've got a right-wing media. I mean, I know it's easier just to sit here and blame the media the
Please
whole time.
Yeah, no, but we do it all
with,
the time.
With some honourable exceptions.
Yeah.
You know, we know the kind of coverage that this agenda gets treated with in so much of the media. So that's part of the answer. But I genuinely would really... It would be such an interesting historical moment to look back at if we are lucky enough to survive this, to go back to this time and think, why is it, knowing what we knew then, we didn't act when we still had time? And that is the question that absolutely keeps me awake at night. Because it's not a lack of evidence. We've got the evidence. It's not a lack of money. We could do this. It's not a lack of technological know-how. We've got that.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it? What is it, the psychological thing that means that we're not jumping out of the boiling water before we get boiled alive?
Well, we were talking to your secretary, Will, before, who said the whole thing is reminiscent of that Netflix movie, Don't Look Up.
You know? Yes.
And it really does, you know. Yeah. I mean, at what point, how bad does it need to get before, you know, this just becomes surreal, the avoidance of what's coming down the road?
I mean, I know you said we weren't going to talk about the whole BBC scandal, but I mean, it is extraordinary that in the same sort of week when, you know, we've just been told that it's been the hottest June ever on record, and what's been leading the news for the last 4 days in a row, you know, and of course it's serious, but it's not of global significance.
No one's going to die because of that.
No.
You know?
As David Wallace Wells says in The Uninhabitable Earth, that it's very hard to make problems in which we're all complicit into good political narratives.
Yep.
And I wonder if you agree with that.
I do agree with that. And yet, you know, that's often used as a way of constraining action and putting all of the responsibility
might be a spur.
It could be, but I worry that one of the logical lines from that is to say that, you know, we're all complicit and therefore individuals need to change and therefore why aren't they? And, you know, there's some truth in that, but there's an awful lot more truth in the fact that we are all living within a system that was not of our creation and that makes it really difficult to change. Yeah. So you're living in a village without a bus service and you're being told to leave your car at home, or, you know, you're being told to insulate your home and you just love to put food on the table, frankly, never mind solar panels on your roof.
Yeah.
So I do think that there's a danger with that argument in the sense that it can make it sound like what we need is only individual behaviour change rather than systems change.
Voluntary behaviour and for some reason businesses to sort everything else.
Yeah.
And the missing part of the trio is serious government action.
Exactly. And yet government is the one that could put in place the enabling framework in a matter of moments if they chose to.
Exactly.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Let's talk about Brexit, because that's our specific bone to chew on. You know, you used the word sabotage. We sabotaged a lot of the progress that we'd made within the European Union, especially on environmental issues. And I wonder how bad you feel the Brexit decision was. We can probably get over that fairly quickly. But also, what you see as a route back, you know, is there a logical route back towards a closer affiliation with the European Union that could get us back on track, or has some of that been lost forever now? Yeah.
Well, it won't surprise your listeners to know that on a kind of a chart of 1 to 10, how serious was the Brexit decision? It's pretty up. Yeah, it's about 9.5, I think, probably. Or 9.8.
Well, where was the missing half?
9.5. Yeah. Come on. I'd love to know.
Blue passports.
The common agricultural policy was pretty crap. But the one that's replacing it hasn't been brilliant yet either. Yeah. I think it was deeply serious, and I feel so angry with the campaign that led up to it. And I feel angry with myself. Of all the votes that I have cast in my 13 years in Parliament, the one that I regret the most was voting for there to be a referendum. And I did vote in favour of that. And I voted for that because I'd been a member of the European Parliament for 10 years, and I had sympathy with the view that there'd never been a real debate about the European Union and why we were members and what the advantages were. And I so naively now, as I think back to it, thought that if we had the referendum, we could have an honest conversation about it and a discussion, and people would learn exactly what the EU does. And what made me so angry was the fact that the media never covered seriously what was happening in the EU. And I used to notice that, you know, day after day, as you go into the Parliament in Brussels, you'd see the headlines on all the other German papers, French papers, Italian papers, and they would often cover what was being discussed in the European Parliament. Never, ever in the British papers, unless it was Boris Johnson and his bloody bent bananas. So it's not surprising that people didn't really know the benefits of being part of the EU. So it was deeply serious. It was a horribly flawed campaign. We didn't need to lose that campaign. It was just fought so
badly.
Lots
of complacency all around,
And so transactional. You know, the other side was talking about hearts and minds and sovereignty, and we were talking about, you know, how much your sausages cost in your supermarket trolley. You know, it was no contest.
So
that's part of it. Part of it, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, to look at the polls and the number of people now who are willing to say that they think it was a mistake, which I think is a positive thing. In terms of a route back, I think there will be a route back. I think the question is how long it's going to take and how much damage gets done before we arrive. And of course, you know, what terms it will be on, because we were very blessed in the terms that we had before, in terms of the opt-outs that we had, in terms of the single currency and so on and so forth. What that will look like if and when we go back in, I'm not sure. But
hard to imagine us being readmitted without signing up to Schengen and the Euro, isn't it?
It is hard, but on the other hand, I just sense that at a time when there is so much insecurity in the world, maybe some of those calculations might be different. I think the bigger thing to get over is that I think that the rest of the EU would want to know that it was the settled view of a majority in the country. I think that's the big thing. And so that's why I say, you know, even if the polls now are saying, what is it, 56% or something like that, who would be in favour of returning? I think it's got to be a bit more than that, and it's got to be for longer to demonstrate that that is a settled view. But I think if it were, then I think some of those issues probably could be negotiated.
Interesting. Yeah, interestingly, I think the, you know, that 56 or 58%, whatever it is, disproportionately the younger people are crying out for
the demographics,
which I find personally like really encouraging.
Yep.
And actually it brings me on to another tangential question, which is about 16 and 17 year olds, you know, and should we enfranchise a younger group of people who would perhaps be more influential in politics day to day and certainly more engaged than a lot of the older demographic.
It's long-standing Green Party policy to bring in votes at 16, and I know, you know, the criticism is always that, well, people at the age of 16 don't necessarily know what they're voting for, but as I always say, if that was going to be the criterion in order to be able to have the vote, then you'd be ruling out a hell of a lot more people of all age groups who would no longer be eligible. So I think you know, of course we'd need to have more teaching of politics in schools, and that would be an entirely positive thing. But it's young people's futures.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we're trashing, frankly, right now. And so it feels to me like they absolutely should have a say over it.
You know, you've talked in the past about being very interested in how young people approach activism and social media and how committed they are to causes. What can we learn, or what should we adopt from other countries, perhaps, or other political systems, about how we could reform our own political system so that there was a more... a greater equilibrium across the demographics, and people were, especially that younger audience, were more influential in how we look at politics.
Well, I think the other side of giving 16-year-olds the vote would be to make sure their votes actually count.
Yeah, right.
And that would be, you know, fairly predictably, perhaps, for me to say, to bring in a fairer voting system. And that's not only because smaller parties like the Green Party would do much better, though we would, but it is about giving people from a very young age the faith and confidence that their vote counts, that their voice matters, that they can change things. And at the moment, you know, if you're a young person living in, you know, huge numbers of constituencies around the country, you know that failing a revolution, the same party is going to get back in time and time and time again, which is utterly disenfranchising, disillusioning, disengaging, you know. And so it's not surprising that more young people are kind of sceptical about the power of voting. So,
but, I mean, given how bloody obvious that solution is, you know, if you were started from a blank piece of paper, yeah, there's no way you'd have this current system. It's obscene, actually.
It is.
What would have to happen before all this talk about PR became reality?
I'm sorry to have another go at Keir Starmer, but I'm going to, because you know, there was a fantastic campaign that was run inside the Labour Party, for whom I have, you know, such respect for the people who ran that campaign, because it took so much time and effort and energy and imagination to get a majority of people at Labour Party conference last time around to vote in favour of changing the voting system, and the unions, to get them on board as well, was no small feat. So to have done all of that and then to have Keir Starmer turn around and say, well, over my dead body, it ain't going in the manifesto, I think was such a slap in the face, and also just so short-sighted, because right now, of course, Labour's riding high in the polls, and maybe under current calculations, although there are some questions about it, maybe PR wouldn't make that much difference to them right now. But if he's serious about the transformative nature of the kind of programme he wants to bring in, he's going to need more than one term of office. He's going to need at least two. And once you've been in office for a term, you're not going to be guaranteed to be 20 points ahead or 15 points ahead or whatever else. So you would have thought that in his own mind, it would have been worth adopting a different electoral system. But he's so scared of being painted as weak that he won't do it. And instead of which, we see these ridiculous tribal loyalties coming out, which means that people like Neil Lawson are being threatened with expulsion from the Labour Party, you know, simply for liking a tweet or for retweeting something that was talking about, you know, the importance of parties broadly on the centre and the left working together.
Yeah, it seems crazy.
Can I ask about, related to that, Caroline, you mentioned earlier trust in the political system and Parliament specifically. And I think we all, Matt and myself, were very impressed by the speech you gave on the Monday after the Privileges Committee report came out on Boris Johnson's COVID lies. And it was very impassioned, but also very much to the point, which was that we'd reached a moment of complicity and cowardice. And I wondered, it's now more than a quarter century since the Nolan report. What practical things can be done to make the system of ethical regulation generate not just better behaviour, but also a better ethos within the political world?
Mm. Well, I mean, some of the changes are relatively straightforward, in the sense that it is an extraordinary anomaly that that the ministerial code applies to everybody except the Prime Minister, and indeed that he's the only arbiter of it in terms of who else it's going to apply to. So
he can initiate investigations by his advisor.
Exactly. So he has an ethics advisor, but that ethics advisor is incredibly constrained into what they can look at. So, you know, if you or I had a concern about somebody and went to the ethics advisor and said, could you look at this? They can't, unless the Prime Minister gives the go-ahead, which just doesn't make sense. So I think there are some things that one could do, like giving that ethics advisor a much stronger remit and making sure that the ministerial code had some kind of independent oversight. And I know people start getting twitchy when you suggest that, because they say, you know, you can't have lay people having powers over elected people. And I get that if you're elected, in a sense, you are answerable to your electorate more than you are to, you know, a person who is tasked to look over you. But it would not be beyond the realms of imagination to think of some constellation of liaison committee chairs, for example, which are the most senior committee chairs in Parliament, who already have quite a lot of influence. You could imagine some system of checks and balances such that you're still having elected people making some of these decisions over the fitness of others to be in Parliament, without it only remaining in the hands of one person, the Prime Minister. And I think, you know, originally we had a much more far-reaching recall system, where constituents could recall their MPs more easily than having to jump through the 10%, and they can only do that if Parliament has basically banned the person for 10 days or more or whatever. Yeah. So there are ways that we could have made MPs, all MPs, more accountable to their constituents. And there are ways that we could have ensure that all power doesn't just rest with one prime minister. Because it just feels so, so quaint, really, that the people who drew up the original laws and rules would have just thought that, you know, honourable members behave honourably and
good
therefore
chaps.
Right honourable members. Exactly, the good chaps theory of government. Well, I think it's been shown fairly...
Tested that one to destruction, haven't we?
Yeah,
the fact that you
so
can't
well.
Call someone... You can't call a liar a liar in the mother of all parliaments, I think, is probably symptomatic of the issue.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Why are you leaving?
Why are you leaving?
Listen, you're sitting on a bulletproof majority. 20,000 or just a few votes short? You could go on. I mean, why are you leaving?
I am leaving in the hope and expectation that the seat will be filled by another Green. So there will still be at least and hopefully several more than just one Green here in Parliament. But I'm leaving because the thing that motivates me most of all is action around climate. And as an MP, and particularly as the only MP of my party, I have to be the expert on everything. I have to be the front bench person on education and economics and Brexit and just everything.
Yeah.
And so you're just skating so thinly to do that. And then easily 2 days a week is spent doing constituency work. And
right.
I think a lot of people haven't really caught up now with just how much constituency work there is. And I think that has changed a lot over the last couple of decades, because as so many other public services are just decimated, it feels like the MP's office is just about the only thing that's left standing in some constituencies. And so you get so many inquiries and pleas for help, where in the past you might have been able to direct them to, you know, a local NGO or more resources at the council or, you know, some other body that might be able to help. And now all of that's gone.
Yeah.
And so that's massively important. But again, it's just such a diversion from...
Yeah.
Where I want to put my energies now.
Just on that constituency work, is there a pattern to the kind of complaints or inquiries or questions that your constituents need you to help with? What is the kind of the worst lump of people?
The Home Office.
The Home Office, right, okay.
I think if you were to ask almost anybody
here,
they would say of all the departments, the one that is most dysfunctional and causes all of us most distress is the Home Office,
right.
Just because, you know, you never get the answers out of them and people, you know, just aren't being treated properly by them.
And is that just incompetence or is that like just cultural bloody-mindedness?
I mean, I'm sure there are some really good people who work at the Home Office and I don't want to be tarring them with that same brush. But I imagine, like all departments, they are massively overworked and understaffed. I imagine, I should have thought at least, that morale is probably relatively low.
Yeah, well, you've got to work with Suella Braverman, haven't
quite,
you?
Yes. Well, people have our deepest sympathy. So there is that. I mean, beyond that, I think talking to my colleagues, the picture of what the biggest constituency issues are is very different constituency by constituency. I mean, in Brighton, housing is one of the biggest issues, just the lack of affordable housing, the terrible quality of the housing that there is.
So once you're liberated from all the 2 days a week constituency work, having to know about Brexit and this, that, and the
I'm going to change the world. Just
yes, how are you? How do you intend to change the world?
I wish I had an answer to that question.
Because you're a workaholic, aren't you?
I'm a bit.
You work very hard.
I work quite hard. But
you're not going to just go and
I'm not going to go
garden.
Away with my knitting, no. But genuinely, I haven't yet worked out what it's going to look like. And the reason for that is, you know, like many others, I do work 80 hours a week at this job. It is all-encompassing. And just having the space to step back and breathe and just take stock and work out, you know, where best next.
Yeah.
'Cause
one thing you are doing, though, is this extraordinary, the doula work. With the dying.
We do work with the dying, yes.
What's that about?
It's about living, actually, which is what makes it so exciting. So this is a wonderful organisation called Living Well, Dying Well, which is based in Lewes, just up the road from Brighton. And they train people to spend time with people towards the end of their lives. And the theory behind it is that we have kind of medicalised death to a huge degree. And of course, sometimes that is exactly what you want. If you've just had a heart attack, then having a medical approach to your situation is very helpful. But so many people don't need that and don't want that. And in fact, you know, the vast majority of us would want to die at home if we possibly can. And so it's about how we relearn what we used to know about death and dying and how we have much more of a community-based response to it.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is that it just cuts through the crap. You know, when you're talking to someone who's dying, or even if you're just talking about dying in general, then it does focus your mind on what matters. And it does make you appreciate every every last minute of every last hour that you have, doesn't it?
Is it the case that as has often been said, especially recently, that the dying never say, "I wish I'd worked harder"?
Exactly.
Or I should earn more.
Yeah.
All their regrets, if they have them,
yeah,
are connected to, I wish I'd spent more time with my loved ones.
Exactly.
I wish I'd spent more time on my things I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
Is that what you're experiencing?
That's certainly what I'm experiencing. And I just think it's such a privilege and a reminder to
such a lesson,
to have
isn't it?
That.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Before it is too late. Cause
absolutely.
Obviously, hopefully one will come to that conclusion when there's still time to do something
exactly.
about it.
Well, talking of time, just one last question. And it's such a broad question that you can answer it any which way you like, but when you look ahead 25 years towards 2050, you know, where we're meant to be this net zero, what do you think Britain's going to look like and feel like? What's in your head, for better or worse, what kind of country will Britain be, do you think?
I mean, I just think we are at a crossroads right now. And I mean, I know you could say that at any time, but it does feel as if the two different directions feel more stark than in recent years, for sure. And obviously, one of those routes does lead to an incredibly dark and terrible place, really. I mean, if we don't deal with the climate and nature emergencies with the speed that's needed, and if we carry on with governments that are as draconian and as illiberal and as populist and worse as we have right now, then that picture is a very grim one. But I do genuinely think that there is an incredibly good chance that we will wake up in time, and that in terms of answering that question, one could imagine a time when, you know, we have had the green transition and our energy is being produced more by renewables, and people have a roof over their heads and they might have a universal basic income, and that they're not feeling so insecure. I mean, that is all within our grasp, and I suppose I want to answer it that way, because I think hope is an incredibly important thing. Not hope just in the sense of a lottery ticket that you clutch as you sit on your sofa, as it's been put, but hope is something that will get you out the door and make you change things. And we do have it within our powers and within our economic means to ensure that everybody has enough, that we live in harmony with this precious earth and the species that we're blessed to share it with, that we live with a richness and an appreciation, which links back to the work on death in a way, of just realising what life could be like. So I'm going to plump for that one, please.
Terrific.
That's the one I want.
Great. Option A, we like it.
We're with you.
We're definitely with you.
Non-grim option. Yeah. Caroline, thank you so much for being our first guest. I hope you've enjoyed it. We've enjoyed it tremendously.
Tremendous.
Thank you very much.
So I hope you'll agree that was a fascinating chat with a quite brilliant politician. And please, folks, remember the latest edition of The New European, which is the newspaper that brings you this wonderful podcast, is on newsstands now, as well as on our website. That's at theneweuropean.co.uk. And listeners to the Two Mats podcast can get a great deal on a subscription. Just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And if you sign up, I will give you a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover, which are flying off the shelves like hotcakes. Thanks, as ever, to our wonderful producer, the third Matt. That's Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.